tu, sahanau punaktu, sahabiryam karavavahai, tejasvina adhitamastu mavitvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti.
I experience some loss of identity at moments when I don't feel how to connect to that which is me. It can feel very scary. Do you have any tips for that? Well, in some ways, I feel that we're always having that scary sensation in one way or another. Because whenever you're not with yourself or your mind doesn't have some shanti, so your own presence is very much, you know, reflected and alive in the mind, you feel isolated from your own. You just feel isolated. You feel isolated from others. You don't feel loved. You don't feel connected to yourself. And so you may not call it fear, but I think it actually is a very scary thing. And then you try to scramble back somehow or reach out or try to reconnect, you know. So I think it actually happens all of the time. And I think that's a loss of identity in a bigger sense. Because even though that adhyasa, what we call that mutual superimposition, anyonya adhyasa, that mutual superimposition is there, when my mind is quiet, even though I take myself to be my body and my mind and this whole body-mind-sense-organs complex, you know, still, I am shining, you know. So there's no problem whether I'm my body or mind or sense organs, doesn't matter, because my presence is, I'm present, you know, experientially present. But when I get some sort of a reaction, I feel, you know, where the mind becomes dark in one way or another, I feel so, so disconnected. And I think that's a loss of identity. I don't feel like myself, you know. And so I think for us, when we have Vedanta, and more you're learning, in fact, with most of the meditations, they're really about how to get connected. How to bring my mind back, how to bring my hurt mind or my reactive mind or the mind that feels hurt by my relationships and all of this, how to come back, how to bring the mind back, how to go really inside to the real source of the problem, which are sort of the little ones inside, or usually, you know. And even the external problems are usually the little ones inside, because they're projected out. The pain is projected out. You know, and so then learning how to be directly with that pain, and then when I'm having issues with other people, going into those dialogues, and, you know, like we've been doing, going into some dialogues with people who are problematic, and just trying to come home and actually understand what's really going on there. And that's what we have to keep going doing. You can't get disconnected from yourself. In any real way. It's not possible, because your being is not an object in the world. You know, it's not bound by time and space. Nothing can touch you. Nothing can happen. Mind gets a feeling of being disconnected. And so then we have to have the tools to be able to bring my mind home to myself. You know. One thing I think that's useful is when you have a reaction, or you're hurt by somebody, or, you know, feeling hurt or feeling angry or irritated by somebody, it's a nice question to ask yourself, the one so angry and irritated, is what's really hurting you, or what is really irritating you? And I would say I'm almost ready to say 100% of the time. It is something that's deeper, much deeper than that reaction. You know, the reaction is superficial, you know, to that person. But you only ask, what is it? What's that really about? Or an even more specific question is, what am I afraid of? Because really especially all of my angers and irritations and pushing people away and hoping they're not going to be around and all of this kind of stuff is because they're triggering something in me and I'm afraid of that, having to experience that isolation or that agitation or, you know, all kinds of concepts that come up that have to do with being isolated or being left out or being not wanted. Yeah. Oh, it's all, it's endless. But it's nice to take it home inside and then do the work there. Yeah. And do that. Well, we'll talk more about this, but do more of that pratipaksha bhavana to what's outside the person you don't like and all of this you offer, as long as you'll be a long story, you know, that there'll be somebody like the landlord or something, I think was the last one I heard him do. This landlord creating all kinds of problems for the tenant, you know, just complaining all the time and threatening to kick him out and all this kind of stuff. And so he was getting just so tense and he was starting to hate the landlord, you know. And so then he was advised, you know, you do things, just offer him flower every day. Just put a vase, flower vase. A nice flower on his desk. You just do it every day. You don't have to say anything, just put a flower. You know? And after some time, both of them started changing. Mm-hmm. The landlord started changing because he was getting this flower and, you know. You know. Changes you. That's the thing, that some act of kindness or some act of consideration, it just changes you. Things soften up. And the tenant also started softening up. Yeah. So it's a work learning, having that nishta, you know, it's called upaya nishta, having that commitment to kind of working on your mind and the complexes and all of that, where it takes away that isolation, whatever the cause might be. It might be that cat food. Sweet, found the cat food, and I have cat food in my room. She found it, and she was so happy. and Charlie was going, shh. What's the nature of attachment? Why it can be so hard for anyone to let go of a person that we love? Yeah, it's hard. But part of the reason I often think that the work that we do around these kind of pains is work around how to take care of myself and the tremendous hurt I'm feeling and how to survive that. And say I lose a loved one or my relationship breaks up or whatever the reasons are for that loss. A lot of times the focus is how can I survive that pain, you know, and I think it can be a little better just from talking to so many people and seeing how things evolve when the focus is more on how can I let that person go instead of how much I'm in pain. What can I do to let that person go so that we can both have a happy life? You know, And so that person is an obstruction to me and my life, and I'm also do everything I can to let them be free. And the thing is about that is that I'm taking a positive, I've taken a positive acts. That's the Pratipaksha Bhavana. So those positive acts kind of neutralize, take away a whole layer of problem. It takes away a whole layer of problem. And at the same time, my little one can be so hurt and feel so abandoned and unloved, you know. And that's also true, you know, because that abandonment goes right into the little child inside who probably for one reason or another has been abandoned, or most of us have been abandoned in one way or another, or not been the center of attention by our parents to the degree that it's really necessary for a child to have that very firm, strong self-worth and self-esteem and self-structure. It's hard for parents to give that these days, you know, in the degree that is necessary for me to have that sense of natural sense of being loved to the point that I never even think about it. You know, that's really interesting. Even most of us don't have that. You know, we don't have that feeling inside just naturally, so it doesn't even occur to you that you're loved or not loved because you just are, so you don't even have the words for it. For most of us, when we go inside, that feeling of really being wanted or being loved isn't there, you know. And so we have to do a lot of work on that, or just making sure that little one knows, you know, that you are loved and I love you and all of that. But that's a really slow process, and it can go on for a long time, and you have to learn how sometimes just to kind of live with it, you know. It's not hurting you very much because you can neutralize it, but that inner sense of not being wanted or not being loved is profound. I said once with our group, maybe, I don't know if it was this year or not, anyway, Kohut, Heinz Kohut, you know, who's a kind of a famous psychologist for our era, and he looks at that lack of self-worth and self-esteem and feeling loved as the problem of our era. You know, and I think sometimes when I spent all those years in India in the early 70s, and I knew a lot of little children then, because the Indian families would bring their little kids with them, you know. In fact, those kids are grown and they have their own children now. I know them. I've known them all these years. But, you know, I still remember the relationship that the families, especially the moms, had with their children. And this one woman of the family that's very close to Swamiji, you know, she had two little girls. They were maybe like 10 or 11 months apart. And they're always dressed up in their really pretty little dresses. They were like 3 and 4 years old. You know, really, they're just still little girls, you know, just little. They were at 7 or 8. They're like 3, 4. And so they were like little ducklings, you know, the mama duck. And they were just, you know, wherever mama went, they were right behind her, one right beside her, like this one on either side, and they were just kind of walking along with her, holding on to her skirt, you know, her sari. Both be holding on to their sari, and wherever she went, they would just go, and they were just so happy. Because they were never not with her, you know. She was carrying them. If they were, so she sat down, they would be sitting on her lap or sitting right next to her. And you know, those little children, and there were little boy also. That, and this is just one really like archetypal image of this of the beauty of this. Those little girls were so confident and so secure in themselves. They were like little people, you know, who had their minds and their ideas. And of course, and one beautiful thing about the India that I experienced, and of course there's a shadow side to everything, but right for now, this is the beautiful side, you know. Their little opinions, their little 4 or 5 year old opinions were listened to. they would, the parents, you know, and even the older brother. There's a brother that was a couple of years older, Swami, Srimi Swami. They would all listen and pay attention and answer. Like their little adults, their questions and the things they had to say were actually calmly kind of listened to and responded to. And they expected that too, you know. And it was just the cutest thing. It was the cutest thing to see that they were these little adults running around 3, 4, 5 years old. And the kind of love, and they were the center of attention, you know. So they were filled up with this love and respect, as though they were worthy little human beings that were worthy of being listened to and had something to say. And they, of course, the mom would never even consider, you know, having them not right by her side. They were her little ducklings. Yeah, it was just a very, very beautiful thing. And I think in our culture, we really, at least in our culture in the States, we just haven't, the culture itself hasn't allowed for that type of holding, you know, and the pace of the culture hasn't allowed for that type of just being patient and being present, you know. And so we don't, most of us, if you have it, you're very, very fortunate, but most of us really don't have that sense of, you know, just self-worth, self-esteem, being a loved person to the degree that it's not even an issue, you know. So most of us have had to do work to kind of fill that up. Okay. And so that being the case, there's vulnerability, much more vulnerability, not that anybody would not cry and whatnot to lose a loved one, but the amount of shredding and ripping and hurt is quadrupled in a way, because I'm already hurt inside. You know what I'm saying? I'm already hurt inside. And so we have to be with those little ones and fill them up, which we can do. That's the beautiful thing. You know, take some time, but we can do it. May not be perfect. It's not going to be perfect. Like, you know, the psychological example of that's used in the difference for somebody whose psyche has been hurt or badly hurt or traumatized versus somebody who's not ever been hurt. It's like the difference between, say, if there's two beautiful china vases, you know, these big, hand-painted from China, they're just made of the fine china, and they're big like this, and they sit, two of them identical, they sit on either side of the this doorway entrance into a living room. And they're very, very beautiful and very costly also. But one of them had been accidentally knocked over and it just broke into smithereens. And the other one was always whole. But they had to bring in a master craftsman to actually put this thing back together, this vase back together, because there were so many pieces and shards and everything. It took him a long time. And he was able to put it back together so that from the naked eye, you really couldn't tell. You couldn't tell that this one had been cracked and broken and hurt, and this one never had. You couldn't tell. But the vase could tell, right? It could tell. This one could tell what it was. This one could tell what it had been through, you know. Both were whole, but one had a lot of experiences that this one did not have. This one would make a better psychologist. Yeah. Because empathy. Yeah. But see, that's just like what I was saying when we do this deep inner work. What is the gift? One huge gift is your empathy. You know what empathy means? It means, I don't know what the Swedish word is for that. Empathy. Oh, it's empathy? Same thing. Okay. So what it really means when we talk about it psychologically is that I can really on many different levels put myself in your shoes. In other words, I can understand and feel how you feel. That's empathy. I've had those experiences. I know what it is. I can relate to you. You know, that's when you really have empathy. And a person who has empathy also naturally mirrors another person because that you can relate to that person. Mirroring means that you give it's even unconscious. You give an appropriate response. Like, if I really smile at you, then I get a smile back. It matches, you know? And so then we're kind of in a dance together. And if I'm really sad, you're not going, you know? then somehow you have to become really sad, but there'll be an expression and a way of being that will match that. That's what we call mirroring, you know? And so that's when that mirroring is not there also, that's very upsetting. Little children, they actually did tests that they can never do now, but there was did tests without of a little child sitting in front of a mother, and the mother was instructed not to respond at all as the child struggled to get her attention. And the child really, the little children just really decompensated. It started out slowly, getting a little upset. Well, try this way, try it. I'm talking like babies. They're like maybe a year and a half, trying this way, trying that way. And the mother's not doing anything. It must have killed her to even do this, you know? But then the baby would start getting a little upset, and so nothing happening, then more and more, until it literally decompensated into a screaming breakdown. So I guess they proved their point, whatever that was, but certainly very damaging for those children. So those kind of experiments, this was in the 50s, they could never do those things now. I think they didn't know what they were getting into, but yeah. So we learn all of these kind of things, but we also have to learn how to be with the hurt parts when we lose somebody, you know? And to let the more mature part give to the other person their freedom, wish them the best, and move away in a sense, which takes a huge amount of bigness, but that's one side that frees you also. Because what's the alternative? Well, I'll tell you what the alternative, because I've had some experience with it myself. The alternative is that you stay with that hurt and the damage that was brought about by the collapse of that relationship or the betrayal or whatever it was. It stays there inside of you, you know, until you can come to terms with letting it go. And letting it go also involves not just on a surface level, but being able to let the pain or the rancor go toward that person and want them to be happy and regain the lost respect. The lost respect for that person because of what they did and all these kind of things, you know. Of course you have your own perspective on it, but it's not an easy thing, but to be whole inside you have to take these things as sadhanas that put me into a position where I really have to work on all of this so that I can be free inside, you know. There's this one guy, Lukoff is his name. I forget his first name. Fred Lukoff or something like that. He wrote a lot of some books and a lot of YouTubes and things on forgiveness. Puja Swamiji, he doesn't like this word forgiveness. He thinks it's kind of, I don't know, making a person less than you need to be forgiven. But this guy wrote this book on forgiveness because he didn't have an association with the word. So he said the problem is that the person you need to forgive is probably running around and having a great time and living their life, right? And for you, that hurt is taking up just a huge amount of real estate in your mind. And you're with that by yourself, you know? And they're going on with their life. And we don't want these type of things to take up all the real estate in our mind so that all we spend our days doing is revolving around this disaster, you know. It's like we have to let the disaster go. even though it can be hard. You have to work on it. You have to do it on both ends. You have to work on yourself and your own hurt, and you have to work on letting the other person who you once loved so much go.
Can I ask something? How do you see this word forgiveness?
Well, I got so conditioned by Swamiji is that I can't really use that word, because I see it as looking like I'm better than that person. I need to forgive the person. The word that he likes and that I like now is you have to understand. You have to understand the person and what they went through and what, you know, when Swamiji does this. I'm always talking about Swamiji as Pooja Swamiji, because he's my guru, just like he's Vaidyanathan's guru too. So anyway, with what was I saying? I lost my track.
Understand.
Oh yeah, understanding.
Understand what the person.
Yeah, that's what I was going somewhere. Just a minute, I've almost got it. Oh, I don't remember. So forgiveness, there's this one particular thing. I hope it'll come back, but it's gone right now. You know that instead of forgiveness, when there's understanding, I remember. You know that when we're sitting in that meditation, like sometimes I'll have you look at each other, you know, and each other tells the story. I say how you made me feel or how I felt about this whole thing, and then your partner or ex-partner or whatever tells it, everything that he or she felt, you know, and then the little ones talk, and then you can go on from there to look at everything in your past that led up to this and everything in their past that led up to this split, you know, and you get more and more understanding, you know. I found that all of those are good. The one that I think it can be just to me extraordinary is when you actually tell your partner everything that you've been through in an objective way, just trying to let him or her see, to know everything that you've experienced and your little ones have experienced, and then to let your partner say everything that they've experienced and why they felt that way and why this happened and how they feel now. And you would be surprised that how much your psyche is holding about that. It's incredible when you hear the other person talk to you and explain everything. And then when you have their little one say everything, that brings a lot of compassion. When you hear your little one say a lot of things and then you hear their little one say a lot of things, then somehow your heart starts to open up, you know. We just have to work on it for some time, because we're wounded inside. Whenever we're wounded inside, it takes, that wound has to be healed along with a very hard situation that would be hard even if you weren't wounded, you know. It's hard anyway. But then when you're wounded, it's extra hard. So we have to really work on it, decide I want to be free. I want my mind to be free. I want my heart to be as big as Ishwar's. That's the goal. I have a goal. So Swamiji said your heart has to be as big as Ishwar. That means you have to become with all beings the way you are with most beings. It's a funny thing to say. But the people you have really bad time with are probably in one hand, two hand at the most, and everybody else are part of the creation, you know, and you don't have projections on them or anything. So there's an objective relationship there, and there's whatever the shanti that your mind is enjoying is the shanti that they're enjoying in your presence, but it's nothing personal, you know. That's how it is for most of the creation, but there's this handful. Sometimes I call them zingers, you know, things that have really hurt you and penetrated you. Those are the things we have to work on. But it's limited in number. That's a good thing. So anyway, I don't know. What happens after moksha? Where do we really go? What time is it? Well, first thing is that the self, Atman, doesn't go anywhere, right? There's nowhere for it to go because it's free of space and time. So there's never any movement for your being when the creation is here and you're embodied and whatnot, and when the creation is in, you know, pralaya, and there's no creation manifest. So that is totally irrelevant to the self. You simply are the very being which the entire creation enjoys, and which is your very self, that me. So if I got rid of the whole creation, what would be left is me, who I really am. And I would call it me, because the word me or the word I is the word I use to land on, to point to myself, my sense of this personal self that I am. The one that is here for everyone in my experiences, that personal me, is Brahman. So if the whole universe goes away, the personal me is what is left. You know, we think that sense of self is something that is given to me, or something that belongs to the body and mind, and when the body and mind is gone, then that personal sense of self, the one I really care about, that will go. But what we discover is the one I really care about, and which is the me of this body, mind, sense organs, is free of time and space. So it's free, it was always free. There's no transmigration, there's no change, there's no coming and going, there's no change in experience, because from the standpoint of just me, from just consciousness, there is no subject-object relationship, there is no universe, nothing. All of this universe and the jiva and the transmigrating jiva, that all requires the jiva to be there for the universe to be there. You know, if it's not there, then there's no experience of it. You know? So it's like this, I mean, it's an obvious thing, but when you take it to its absolute level, then some people get upset, but... If you lose a sense organ, right, then the sense organ and the sense objects of that sense organ are not there in your experience. So say you were to lose all of your sense organs, then neither those sense organs nor the perceptions which they are instruments for will be there in your field, right? So what if you think, okay, so now I have no sense organs, all I have is my mind. Mind means my buddhi, my emotions, all of these things, yeah? If I lose the mind, then all of those things aren't there. Okay. And so there is no, then what's happened is both the knower and the known, whether it be the mind or the sense organs that really belong to, exist within duality, are responsible for my subject-object perceptions. Just like in the dream, if you're identified with the dream character, then you are experiencing that dream from the standpoint of the dream character. You see that? No? If you have a dream, right, and you have dream characters in the dream, you're identified with one of them, I'm doing this and that in the dream. Okay. That means, and when that's the case, I'm experiencing the dream through the sense organs of that character, dream character, that belongs to the dream. So keeping that dream in mind, okay? If the dream character that I'm identified with is there in the dream, then I experience the dream from within it through the sense organs of that dream character. Okay? If there is no dream character in the dream which I am identified with, then I experience Ishwara. Right. So you have to kind of remember your dreams. Like most of us, maybe everybody has had a dream where sometimes you're experiencing the dream from within it, being identified to a dream character, and sometimes it's just scenery or you're dreaming of a city and all this activity is going on, but you're not identified with anything in it, so then the experience is just of the whole. So in reference to this creation, the experience of the creation from Ishwara's standpoint is just the experience of the whole. It's like infinite creation is like a reflecting mirror of itself. You know? Just like if I ask you to have an imagination of the universe, and you don't put any, and you're not looking at, you're not identified with a character in it, then that whole universe is your imagination. See what I mean? So now, if a person does not have self-knowledge, then the ahankara is there, the I notion. The I notion, the ahankara, means the one who identifies with the body, with the mind, and with the sense organ. So that identity brought about by beginningless ignorance, right? This body, mind, sense organs takes itself to be me. It looks outside for its ananda. It tries to live a day longer because it's trying to be me. It's trying to get me back. Me that is free from time, free from death, whose nature is ananda, whose nature is knowledge. I am the knowledge, the knownness which illumines everything. So the poor jiva, with beginningless ignorance, is running all around, you know, trying to gain a little bit more knowledge, trying to last one more day to keep on existing, trying to become happy, have happy experiences. I'm just trying to get myself, that's all. I want myself back, but I don't know that. You know, I wouldn't say it like that, but everything I say that I want is my own nature. That's what's funny about it. Okay, so the ajnani, the person who doesn't have self-knowledge, will go on transmigrating and kind of running after my raga dvesha, you know? And then according to your karmas, you'll take birth after birth after birth because that impetus is there. I am a limited being and I'm fulfilling my desires, and that's kind of the gasoline that keeps me going. But when a person gains self-knowledge, your whole orientation changes. Now your mind is no longer running after samsara trying to become whole and complete. It's kind of found the treasure at the end of the rainbow, so to speak. What you've been seeking for all along happens to be the very self of the seeker, you know. And when you realize that, now the mind is no longer running around trying to become whole. It is basking in the wholeness of your own being. And so for that mind, that's a mature in your knowledge, for that mind, when this body drops, as far as you're concerned, nothing much happens that any different than what you are right now, because already your mind is with you. That's its love relationship, is with the ananda of your own being. Your love relationship is with ananda. It's not... You're not in love with your partner when he's being a jerk, you know. You want him to come back and be the nice person he's supposed to be so that you can be in love with him, whether you're a girlfriend or whatever. You're in love with ananda. And so when this body drops, because the prarabdha is done, is finished, there is no one there. There's no ajnana, there's no ahankara. The ahankara was all mithya. The body is mithya, the mind is mithya. For it to be mithya for you means you know the satyam, you know myself. Otherwise, mithya means nothing. It's mithya for you, meaning all that is here is only you. That's what makes this mithya. You know, don't think that somebody can say this is mithya if they don't know what is the satyam. You know what is real, because I know the truth of it. I recognize this as mithya. So when this body drops, there is no one there to transmigrate because I am there. I'm not unknown. I am there. And so now I just abide as myself, and myself is Ishwara. It's not like you abide as yourself and there's Ishwara is gone. Ishwara, that Maya Upadi, is what is natural, you know, incidental attribute. Incidental attribute means it brings about no change to the what is there. The Maya belongs to Brahman. It's an incidental attribute of Brahman. It doesn't bring about any change to Brahman, but it's the expression of Brahman. It's a mithya expression of Brahman. You know? And so what is left is you who are Ishwara. That's why really this knowledge is I am Ishwara. Because the truth of Ishwara is only me, is only Brahman, the Satyam. But this Maya Upadi is a natural expression. So you can say, you can't say it's not there or that it's not an experience. It is. Just mithya. So it doesn't have any independent being. But the experience is there. Ishwara is there. Ishwara is the experience of the entire infinite creation as an infinite being. It's like if you have an imagination, the most infinite imagination you can imagine and hold that for a moment, then that infinite imagination enjoys you. It enjoys yourself. You are the self of that, right? Just think about your own imagination. So now think about the manifestation of infinite knowledge is what this infinite creation is, but who's the self of it? It's only me, because there can only be one me. I'm not an object within time and space. So there can't be two of me. What's going to divide me? I have to enter into time and space to be divided. You know? So if I'm overwhelming you, don't worry about it. Just kind of go along for the ride and we'll slow it down and expand all of that. But you asked the question. So in any case, what happens when you get moksha and the body dies? When you get moksha and you're living, then you are walking, you are with one with Ishwara, and at the same time you're walking through yourself as a part to the whole. You know? That's a beautiful thing. When the body dies, then you just are Ishwara. Yeah. We're doing okay. How would you describe what Vedanta is to someone who asks, who doesn't know anything about it? Oh, I've done that one. Oh, there's another half. That's why I put it back in there. Please unfold the words devotee, devi, deva, devata. Devotee, the word devotee means the one, like say, how to say that? Like I could say for Swamiji, if I'm his student, I want moksha myself, and I want to study with him, I would say, I'm his sisha, I'm his student. He's my guru. I could also say, and I'm his devotee. I could say that. That would be fine, you know. But first off, he's my guru, and I'm his sisha, I'm his student. But I'm also devoted to him because everything that he is a role model for me. Something like that, you know. So, but then I say a householder who has a guru, they're not really his student. They look to him for love and inspiration and all that. Then they're devotees, and they view themselves as devotees also. So that's in the guru-sishya or the guru-devotee relationship. Then devotee also is a word used in terms of your ishta-devata. You know, I'm a Shiva, I'm a devotee of Lord Shiva. I'm a devotee of Dakshinamurti. Or you would say, some people will say that, in India they'll say that very easily. You know, means a devotee means I'm devoted to this person, I hold this person as Ishwara, as the Lord. I'm a devotee of Swamiji, then I'm holding really him as Ishwara. Because your guru, you know, is really, from what I was telling you about the Mundaka Upanishad, there is no, the Prarabdha Karma is expressing itself, but the Raga Dvesha is not there. And so there's not very any difference really between the mind of the Guru and the mind of Ishwara in terms of what comes through that mind. The Jiva Srishti is very little there. Jiva Srishti means what the Jiva is concocting and creating, and there's still some a lot of ajnanam, you know, reactions from ajnanam, self-ignorance coming out of all that. That's jiva srishti. I'll go on later about that. But for a mature mahatma or guru, there's very little jiva srishti, and that's why they praise and treat the guru as though they're Ishwara, almost as an ishta devata. Remember one time Swamiji was thinking of shaving his beard, and he did that many, many, many years ago, like, I don't know, 30 or 40, long time ago, but later he was going to do it again. I forget what the reason was, but he was thinking of it, and then he said, I decided not to do it because the devotees have that image of me, like when they do upasana or they'll do meditation on the guru, and Oh, there's all kinds of meditations that can be done like that. And then the Swamiji they know doesn't match this inner Swamiji that's used for Upasana. I thought that, you know, that is true. And once when Swamiji was really ill, he had some serious heart problem, and he was taken to a hospital in Taiwan. Is it Taiwan? I think so. It was near Bangkok. Is that Taiwan?
Thailand.
That's what I meant. Thailand. Yeah. So he was at this hospital, and they shaved him, so he had no beard. And when I saw him, I didn't even know who he was. I'd never seen like his chin and his cheeks and these facial expressions, you know, and his lips and all that. I'd never seen it before. And he just wasn't the guy I knew. He wasn't my Swamiji. And I had to really... And you know what? I was really glad when he grew his beard back. It's so different. It's so different. It was like a different... Because he had a big, thick beard. Not really long, but, you know, it was a full beard. The lip was so, so different. So then I remembered that he had said this, because this was later on when he'd become quite ill. Yeah. I remembered, wow. That's really... You're just so used to that in your mind that it's almost like an Ishtadevata. It's a presence you're carrying around. And this person out here doesn't look like that. Anyway. So, devotee. Devi, and if you say Devi, that's the feminine. That would be the goddess. Or you call all of yourselves are Devis. You know, if you have a Devi circle, that's a circle for the women. Right? Devi is feminine. Deva is masculine. So the gods and the goddesses. Usually Deva is used, because Deva can actually be used for Ishwara, because it comes from the root div, which means to shine, to be light, you know. So it can and is in used in some contexts where it's referring to Ishwara or to the Lord, the one who's self effulgent. But usually when we say Deva and Devi, we're talking about Devi goes to the feminine and Deva goes to the masculine, the man. Devata is actually a feminine ending for any masculine or feminine that holds that rank of being a devata, which means they're some sort of a godlike figure like Vayu or Indra or anyone that holds that kind of stature of being a deva, a god within the pantheon of all of the gods that have different roles and whatnot, they're called devatas. But it's not masculine. The noun is feminine. But it's not referring to masculine or feminine. It's just referring to that rank, you know, in the hierarchy of things, of being a devata. One who controls, has power over certain... Like Vayu is the devata for the wind. If we look at all the laws that govern all the wind as being Vayu. And if we embody the laws of Ishwara that are responsible for the wind, we call that Vayu. The laws responsible for the manifestation of fire, we call Agni. Yeah. So that's a devata, the Agni devata, the Vayu devata. There's one for Prithvi. There's the devata for the earth. Look at the earth as a conscious being. Surya is the devata for the sun. Chandra is the devata for the moon. And this Swamiji once said, any law or any order, whatever the order that you're thinking of that exists in the universe, is a devata. You can view it as a devata. So the number of devatas are infinite. And then the one devata, we don't call devata, but Ishwara, is the one in whom all of these devatas are the, like the organs and the flesh and the what fills the structure, the number of rupas that go long as part of Ishwara's manifestation. All the orders. Swamiji said once, he said, there's so many orders. And he started the biological order, and there's the psychological order, and the botanical order, No. We have 10 minutes, we can do a budget. Can we do it?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah. It's 1/4 for the last one, yes.
Some new ones if you like.
Yeah. Please.
Rama nama tarakam sada bhajore. 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 Rama nama tarakam sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada japore, sada japore. Rama nama tarakam, Rama nama tarakam, sada bhajore, sada bhajore. Rama nama tarakam, Rama nama tarakam, sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada bhajore, sada japore, sada japore. Rama nama tarakam, Rama nama tarakam, sada bhajore, sada bhajore. Rama 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 Jaya, Rama 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 Jaya, Kodanda Rama, Kodanda Rama, Rama 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 Jaya, Rama
Shambho Shankara.
Gangadhara,
Gangajatara,
Gauri Manohara,
Gauri Manohara,
Gangajatara,
Gangajatara,
Gauri Manohara,
Gauri Manohara,
Shambho,
Shambho. Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi.